Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Beckett, and in the early hours of Sunday, the 8th of December, these are our main stories. The United States and Iran have carried out a rare prisoner swap in spite of heightened tensions between them. More than 100 Boko Haram jihadists have graduated from a 3-year de-radicalization program in Niger. Also in this podcast, another warning from scientists. Climate change and pollution are driving oxygen out of the oceans, multiplying the threats to marine life.
The oceans are becoming warmer, more sour, and ultimately breathless.
And
you look like a witch. Like it's a witch's nose. It's a caricature. It's like a caricature of Jewish nose.
How an ID photograph has sparked a debate about anti-Semitism in Sweden. We begin with a rare story of cooperation between Iran and the United States, a prisoner swap. The first hint came courtesy of Twitter in posts from Iran's Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif and the US Secretary of State Mike Pompeo. The men at the centre of the Swiss brokered deal are a Chinese-American scholar, Shuyue Wang, who's been held on spying charges in Iran, and the Iranian professor, Masoud Soleimani, who's been detained in the US. Shivash Mehdi Ardalan from the BBC Persian TV told me more about Professor Soleimani.
He was a prominent Iranian stem cell researcher, a scientist living in Iran. The U.S. officials basically laid a trap for him, not letting him know that there was a warrant out for his arrest. So when he traveled to Chicago, he was detained and held in detention without any explanation as to why, but later found to have been charged with violating the sanctions. Now, he has also two other students who are living inside the U.S. They were also detained and they were freed on bail. We don't know whether their case will be laid to rest as well. One of them was a scientist in her own right who had a breakthrough study on lung transplants.
Interesting timing for his release given the rather fractious state of diplomatic relations between the United States and Iran at the moment.
Absolutely. The Iranians would hope that perhaps the prisoners that they are holding, the U.S. citizens inside Iran, can be used as bargaining chips to exchange them with other Iranian citizens who are being held inside the U.S., whose numbers are, we don't know, but we know they run in dozens. The Iranians apparently had offered a list of 20 prisoners they wanted to have been released from U.S. prisons. They're holding about 4 Americans, 2 of them Iranian Americans, who are being detained in Iran on charges of spying. So whether this means that this is a pretext for bigger negotiations or it just won't go beyond prisoner swap, or whether this will be the only prisoner swap we will see, it remains to be seen.
No hints from Tehran as to where this might lead?
Absolutely not. Not at the moment. The only thing that happened was we saw Mohammad Javad Zarif, Iranian foreign minister, traveling to Switzerland, collecting Masoud Soleimani on his private jet, which was probably a photo op for him, given that 3 weeks ago, Iran had seen massive protests against the government policy of hiking fuel prices. So the government is not very popular at this stage with Iranian public opinion. And this could perhaps be a way of them trying to gain some grounds in the polls or with Iranians.
So much for the Iranian perspective. Now for the view from Washington, our correspondent Chris Buckler.
Mike Pompeo, the US Secretary of State, has been pretty positive already in what he said. At the same time, he also pointed out that there are other Americans detained in Iran, amongst other places, and that they're going to continue to try to bring them home. But if you look carefully at his statement, he says that he's pleased that the Iranian government has been constructive in this matter. That is a sense that perhaps relationships are improving to a certain extent. And certainly there are officials that are saying, you know, we're quite willing to go to the conversations and have talks at a table. This could be the momentum. But it feels too early to say that. And certainly President Trump has been at pains times and times again to say he's quite willing to open lines of communication. He's quite happy to have talks without preconditions. But actually, there are other occasions whenever he can be fierce. And you've got to look back over the past year whenever we have had that moment when, for example, President Trump actually just pulled back from conflict with Iran after the shooting down of American drone. Things can change rapidly in Washington at the moment under the Trump administration. And you do get a feeling at this stage things are looking positive, but you really don't know where that will lead.
But it has the potential, though, to have wider significance here.
Yeah, it's difficult to say because President Trump can be so difficult on foreign policy. It is worth just remembering, for example, with North Korea, how essentially he was threatening conflict, describing Kim Jong-un as little rocket man and really talking language of fire and fury. And then all of a sudden, just things changed very, very quickly. And you always get the impression that is possible with Iran. At the same time, it's also going to need Tehran to change their point of view and believe that they'll get something from America. Now, there are indications that Tehran has problems because of sanctions. American sanctions are genuinely hurting. And we have, of course, seen protests in Iran, not least because of fuel prices. And perhaps that could be something that pushes them to want to have conversations with the Americans.
Chris Buckler there. Now to Niger, where more than 100 Boko Haram jihadists have graduated from a 3-year de-radicalization program. Our Africa editor Will Ross told me more.
It's lasted about 3 years, and hundreds of former Boko Haram members surrendered as part of an amnesty. And in Niger, they've been undergoing this 3-year program that's included a kind of religious reorientation, psychosocial support, so trying to get them ready for when they go back into society, back to live with their families, and also some vocational training, including tailoring and carpentry. And it's really been a program that's aimed to ensure that all of them have completely turned their backs on the Boko Haram group. Although some of them say they didn't join it willingly, they were forced to join when the jihadists stormed through the villages and captured them.
How large is the ongoing problem with Boko Haram and violence?
It is still a huge problem. In Niger, there are about 120,000 refugees from across the border in Nigeria who have fled the attacks in Nigeria. But there are also quite a lot of attacks in Niger itself, in that southeastern corner, the Diffa region. In October, 12 soldiers were killed in an attack on a military base in Niger. But there have also been a lot of small attacks on the villages. People are very vulnerable in these outlying villages scattered around southeast Nigeria. And because Boko Haram is still such a threat and people are so angry that they can't get on with their farming and their normal lives, it's going to be difficult for these former Boko Haram members to be accepted back in the villages because people will be very suspicious and worried about having them back living amongst them.
Will Ross. Japan's news agency Kyodo says it's seen documents that give previously unknown details about brothels run by the Japanese army during the Second World War. The issue still taints Japan's relations with its neighbours. Michael Bristow reports.
Tens of thousands of women, most of them Korean, were forced to work in brothels for Japanese soldiers during the Second World War. Back in 1993, the Japanese government admitted the Imperial Army's complicity and apologised. But these documents, collected by the Japanese cabinet over the last 2 years and reviewed by Kyodo, provide some new details. In one dispatch, a Japanese consul in occupied territory in China requests one prostitute for every 70 soldiers and said the Navy had asked for 150 more women. Another document shows how the comfort women, as they're euphemistically known in Japan, advanced with troops as they marched deeper into China. There's been no comment on the documents yet by the Japanese government. Tokyo's wartime aggression still colours its relations with other nations in East Asia, particularly with South Korea. At the moment, the two countries are locked in a trade war over compensation claims for Koreans used as slave labour during the conflict.
A Jewish journalist in Stockholm has filed an official complaint against the Swedish police after the photograph on her official ID card distorted her nose into resembling what she said was an anti-Semitic caricature. Annika Honroth-Rostein says she checked that the photo booth image she submitted to police was fine, but felt too humiliated to speak out when she collected the card. Here's our Europe regional editor, Mike Sanders.
Annika Hernroth-Rothstein is known as a strong advocate for Israel. She told police when renewing her national identity card that she was working for an Israeli newspaper. She can't say for sure that the image on her ID has been deliberately altered, but the nose is elongated to grotesque proportions, an age-old anti-Semitic stereotype. She regrets doing nothing about it at the time.
Part of the embarrassing thing is that I said nothing. I think I was dumbfounded and shocked. I looked at it and it's absurd. Like, it's a witch's nose. It's a caricature. It's like a caricature of Jewish nose.
She was persuaded by a non-Jewish friend to post the picture on Twitter. Much of the reaction there has been supportive of her, but one user accused her of classic victimhood and another exhorted her to leave their country. She is Swedish. She says Swedish politicians find it hard to tackle issues that run counter to the country's progressive image.
We know in cities like Malmö, for example, where you've had an explosion in anti-Semitism and complete political impotence and silence for the better part of a decade, there seems to be a willful political ignorance about it. It's one of the last taboos that we don't really want to discuss, that not only is there imported anti-Semitism, but the issue is that Europe has an anti-Semitism problem, and it has for decades and decades and decades. And we maybe think that just by saying, you know, never again 75 years ago, it all went away. But this is something that's ingrained in the European soul, I think.
Swedish police have invited her to contact them as soon as possible. In a statement, they said they would trace the process back to see if manipulation had happened or if the image was distorted by shadows or bad resolution. But they acknowledged that in a fully digital process like theirs, there's always a risk that systems are manipulated.
Mike Sanders reporting. You're listening to Global News, the best stories, interviews and on-the-spot reporting from the BBC World Service. Every weekend you can hear a review of the week's main news stories and why they matter. That's in The World This Week, and Caroline Wyatt joins me now to tell me what's in the latest edition.
This week, NATO found a new challenge, China, to unite the 70-year-old alliance, despite divisions among its leaders. President Donald Trump left the London meeting early, arriving home to a different storm, confirmation that the House of Representatives will file impeachment charges against him. We'll ask why Malta's Prime Minister has promised to step down, and how a trial over the murder of a journalist in 2017 is worrying the government there. We'll also take a closer look at why some of China's citizens fear that facial recognition has gone too far. And we'll hear what the voters think, with the British general election less than a week away.
Thanks, Caroline. And that's all in The World This Week, broadcast on Saturdays and Sundays and available to download from our website, www.bbc.co.uk/programmes. And still to come in this podcast, the body of a Japanese doctor killed last week in Afghanistan is flown home. The governor of the province where he lived insists his death will not be in vain.
By his assassination, the tourists and the criminals, they will not achieve the goals they want to stop progress in that region.
But first, yet another climate warning, this time that the world's oceans are losing some of the oxygen they hold. And according to a new report by the International Union for the Conservation of Nature, that loss is having dire effects on marine life, disrupting ecosystems and threatening fish species. Mina Epps is the Global Marine and Polar Programme Director for the body behind the report.
2% might sound insignificant, but we know from the climate change debate that these will have huge and enormous implications. So that's an average, but the projections are actually there will be a further increase by 3 to 4% by 2100. I mean, the impacts of the loss of oxygen in our ocean should matter to all, because it actually causes loss of biodiversity, loss of biomass, habitats are shrinking, and it also alters these energy and biochemical cycles significantly.
So the role of oxygen in the world's ocean, what role does it play that makes it so crucial?
When we lose the oxygen in the ocean, it's hard to breathe on the water as it is. And especially fish species such as your tunas, your billfish, they have a very high metabolic rate. So they need very oxygen-rich waters. And if oxygen goes down, that means that they will have to move to more oxygen-rich waters. It might be closer to the surface. It might be migrating to cooler waters in the north. So if you take, for example, the blue marlin outside the coast of US, it dives a half a mile to get its feed and then come up again. Whereas now we're seeing off the coast of Guatemala in Costa Rica, they actually stay by the surface because they cannot do this vertical migrations.
And I understand that the ocean plays a crucial role too in the battle against climate change, that it currently absorbs around a quarter of all fossil fuel emissions. But your report seems to say there are fears it could reach a saturation point.
Yes, that is one very alarming fact, because as you said, the ocean not only provides the food and carbon storage, it's part of the regulatory system and it generates oxygen. So we often talk about the deadly trio, which is basically ocean warming, ocean acidification, but also ocean deoxygenation. So that's kind of a very deadly combination. The oceans are becoming warmer, more sour, and ultimately breathless. So if you have hypoxic dead zone, for example, we saw as an example off the coast of Panama, it resulted in a decline of 75% of coral diversity.
When you hypoxic dead zone, it means where nothing can grow or?
No oxygen. You know, most living organism, we need oxygen to sustain. But in this case, actually, as we're sucking the oxygen out of ocean, we are threatening that very life support that we're so dependent on.
The scientific explanation for that losing of oxygen, is it because of the absorption of the fossil fuels? Is it because of the warming of the oceans? How does it actually happen?
The primary cause of deoxygenation is actually nutrients. So nutrients actually coming from land or being so that's the main cause. It also, for example, it's been mainly around 30 to 40 kilometers off the coast and in closed seas. But what we're seeing now is that it's also happening in the wider ocean and out at sea. And warmer water, the oceans are warming as a result of climate change, and warmer water holds less oxygen.
And on top of that, there are all the other problems we hear about the overfishing, plastic pollution. So the oceans are literally fighting to survive.
Yes, they're fighting for their survival, but also our own very own survival depends on this. So it's a crucial, not just for food, it's a carbon storage, oxygen generation, and this regulatory system that it has. One effect of ocean deoxygenation is also that it will alter energy and biochemical cycles. And as an example is these upwelling system, which brings like nutrient-rich waters to the surface, and that a lot of our key commercial fish stocks are dependent on. So if that can no longer be sustained, nor can the fish population, the fish biomass. So they will be directly threatened by lower oxygen.
Mina Epps talking to my colleague, Lise Doucette. Universal basic income isn't a new idea, nor is it that complicated. Every individual is given a small amount of money to prevent them from falling below a certain level of living. One of the first advocates was Martin Luther King in the 1960s, and it's risen to prominence again in the 2020 Democratic primary race. Opponents, however, say it's a lazy solution that fails to solve the real problem. My colleague Sophie Long has been to Stockton in California, where a trial is underway to see if the idea could actually work.
125 families are being given $500 a month, no strings attached. Virginia Medina, a 61-year-old retired state employee, is one of them.
Wow! That's exactly what I said. My husband goes, wow, what? And I said, I'm going to get an extra $500 a month. And then he said, for what? And I said, for nothing. And he said, what do you mean for nothing?
What did you spend your first seed payment on?
I paid off a bill that I had not been able to pay off. Then I bought extra groceries, was able to put some extra food in the freezer.
Virginia says her health is better. She's less stressed and able to eat more healthily.
All right, that's evidence, boy.
Tomas Vargas was not dealt a great hand in life. He was sleeping rough by the age of 10. In 1 year, he lost 13 friends, most to gun crime. He had no reason to believe his life would end any differently. But having children made him want to change that, and the Seed Project has helped him to do it. It meant he could afford to take a day off work to interview for a better job.
A lot of people out here, we don't have that cushion, we don't have that time. We can't go without those couple of days without having income coming in. It's just easier to stick where you're at and just be there miserable than it is to try to make that leap. A lot of people are too scared to do it because they can't.
Before Seed, Tomás said he felt he was drowning. He was depressed and miserable, constantly concerned about how he'd get his family through the month. The impact of this programme on the lives of many of those taking part goes way beyond financial stability. People talk about feeling more connected to their families, their neighbourhood and their city. But it's small and it's funded by a private grant. So could it ever work on a statewide or nationwide scale? Hilary Hoynes is Professor of Economics and Public Policy at the University of California, Berkeley.
It comes down to the revenues necessary to fund it. So taking the SEED program national at a fully universal rate costs about $3 trillion. And that's more than we spend collectively in the United States on all of our social safety nets.
Universal basic income is extremely expensive, but it's an old idea with new advocates, which is gaining momentum. And there's a sense of pride here amongst those in the SEED programme that they're part of a growing conversation that could, potentially, help others across California and even the country.
Sophie Long. Afghans have been bidding farewell to a Japanese doctor who helped thousands of people before he was shot dead last week in a roadside attack in eastern Afghanistan. Family and colleagues of Tetsu Nakamura, affectionately known as Uncle Murad, had flown from Japan to bring his body home. The 73-year-old's death has sparked anguish and anger across the country. But just why was he so highly regarded? Shah Mahmud Mirkal is the provincial governor of the eastern Afghan province of Nangarhar, where Dr. Nakamura worked.
First of all, he was a humble person, very modest, dedicated to help and serve the people of Nangarhar. He himself was living among the community. He, you know, started excellent projects to irrigate lands and provide living opportunity for thousands of people in that area. He started work in Afghanistan for several decades, but in the last 10, 11 years, he dedicated himself completely after his friend Kazamura, when he was killed in the same place in Khyber districts. So he dedicated his life to accomplish his dream and also to serve the people.
But it was extraordinary that he worked in this eastern province of Jalalabad, where you're the governor. Hundreds of thousands of people that benefited from his irrigation projects. But the tributes for him seem to go right across Afghanistan with candlelight vigils. His face has been painted everywhere, including even on Afghan National Airlines. Why did he touch so many?
People of Afghanistan respect those people who serve them, Afghans or non-Afghans. And people of Afghanistan are always appreciate the good services of good people. His work was known because many people were visiting Nangarhar. They were going to his Nakamura Park. They were seeing those projects. And every day, you know, thousands of people going on that route. So this was very known in the country.
And now we understand that CCTV footage has emerged of the moment when his convoy came under fire. Do you have any leads as to who might have wanted him dead and his colleagues? Because five Afghans obviously died with him.
Five colleagues who were, killed. One was his driver. The four other was police and bodyguard. Yes, we have seen that footage and we are investigating every lead to find who is behind that. But as you see the reaction of the people, this is, happened by those who doesn't want Afghanistan progress and those who work for Afghanistan, the Afghans or non-Afghans. You know, they kill so many of our engineers, doctors, educated people, our religious scholars. They, kill so many other people. So this was the enemies of Afghanistan and the terrorists. They wanted to send, signal that still they can create a problem and they just kill those who serve Afghanistan and this region. Today, I had a discussion with his family and also the organization he worked for that has a 12,000 members in Japan. They said they will not stop their work even a single day. So by his assassination, the terrorists and the criminals, they will not achieve the goals they want to stop progress in that region.
Shah Mahmud Mirkal talking to the BBC's Lise Doucette. One of the world's most famous opera houses, the Vienna State Opera, is staging an opera by a woman for the first time in its 150-year history. The Austrian composer Olga Neuwirth has written an opera based on Virginia Woolf's novel Orlando, which deals with themes of gender fluidity and duality. Bethany Bell reports from Vienna.
The singer, Kate Lindsay, who plays Orlando, walks on stage wearing a brilliant red dress by the designer Rei Kawakubo of Comme des Garçons. The character of Orlando, who lives for centuries, begins as a man in Elizabethan England, but changes into a woman. The composer, Olga Neuwirth, says androgyny and the rejection of gender stereotypes has inspired her ever since she first read Virginia Woolf's novel as a teenager.
Not only it's a journey through centuries, but it's a journey of constant questioning of imposed norms by society, and society is made by men. So Orlando, for all of us, should be a symbol of freedom, humanity, and the freedom of opinion, but also in a very playful and ironic way, which I like so much.
You are the first female composer to have a work premiered here at the Vienna State Opera. How does that feel?
I mean, it feels a little bit strange because one has to consider it's about 150 years. It's a long time. If you're the first, there has to be a second and a third and so on and so on. So it's always good to have a starting point.
I'm at a rehearsal for Orlando at the Vienna State Opera House. And musically, this piece reflects the in-betweenness of the story of Orlando. As well as the classical orchestra on stage, there is an electric guitarist and a drum kit. For the transgender and transgenre artist, Justin Vivian Bond, who plays the role of Orlando's child, this opera has a personal significance.
Conceptually, I am the legacy of what the novel Orlando began to express about gender and transgression and about, you know, the difference between what it's actually like to be a man or a woman, if indeed there is that much of a difference. And since I'm a non-binary person who's trans feminine, I guess you could say, I am happily stepping into a moment, and I guess I'm the sort of representation of where we've come.
Justin Vivian Bond, ending that report from Bethany Bell in Vienna. And that's all from us for now, but there will be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this edition or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Tanya Beckett. Until next time, goodbye.